From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
The evidence was so clear. The argument that people didn't know, particularly at the highest levels of governments, that as Clinton told the Rwandans, you know, your voices didn't penetrate into my office. That's not true. They knew.
Alison DeForge, one of the world's foremost experts on the genocide in Rwanda. She died along with 49 other people in Flight 3407 that crashed in icy weather near Buffalo, New York. We'll remember her life and work with Kenneth Roth, executive director of Human Rights Watch. Then he's met with Nelson Mandela, the founding president of Ghana and Kenya, Kwame Nkrumah and Jomo Kenyatta. He had tea with the Indian prime minister. He sat with Muammar Gaddafi in his tent in Libya. He's met with the Queen of England and was expelled from Uganda by Idi Amin. Today, a conversation with the Pan-Africanist professor, Ali Masrui. He teaches at Binghamton, New York, and is chancellor of a university in Kenya. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. A pair of U.S. missile strikes over the past 3 days have killed 61 people in Pakistan. On Saturday, a remote-controlled U.S. drone bombed three compounds in South Waziristan, killing 30. Earlier today, another U.S. drone attack struck the Kumin tribal region, killing 31 people. The U.S. has now struck Pakistan at least three times since President Obama took office. The attacks come days after Senator Dianne Feinstein, the chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee, became the first U.S. politician to publicly state the U.S. is using a Pakistani base to carry out the strikes. During a congressional hearing, Feinstein said, quote, "As I understand it, these are flown out of a Pakistani base. Until now, the Pakistani government has attempted to distance itself from the U.S. airstrikes." Meanwhile, the Pakistan and Taliban militants appear close to reaching a ceasefire in the Malakand region of northern Pakistan. Under the deal, the government said it would allow the region to be ruled under Islamic or Sharia law. The deal was announced on the same day Pakistani President Asif Zardari said the Taliban was trying to take over the state of Pakistan. Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez won a referendum vote Sunday to remove term limits, paving the way for him to run again in 2013. Electoral authorities said 54% of the voters approved the constitutional amendment to remove term limits for all politicians. Chavez held a victory celebration in Caracas last night.
El pueblo venezolano hoy está irradiando.
The Venezuelan people today radiate their light and democratic revolutionary virtues to the entire world. Let the world see this light and the people of Simón Bolívar.
The British and French governments are being accused of covering up a recent collision between two nuclear-armed submarines in the Atlantic Ocean. The accident occurred on February 3rd or 4th, but wasn't publicly known until today. The British sub, the HMS Vanguard, was armed with 16 nuclear ballistic missiles. The French sub was carrying a similar load. It's unknown whether the collision caused a radioactive leak. Kate Hudson of the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament said, quote, "This is a nuclear nightmare of the highest order. The collision of two submarines, both with nuclear reactors and nuclear weapons on board, could have released vast amounts of radiation and scattered scores of nuclear warheads across the seabed." In economic news, the UN's International Labor Organization's estimating the global economic crisis could result in a staggering 50 million workers to lose their jobs. The UN agency's chief, Juan Somavia, said, quote, "I sense a huge popular frustration brewing." Somavia said the current economic squeeze is provoking tensions, political uncertainties, and even possible security risks. Last week, Dennis Blair, the nation's new director of intelligence, warned the current global economic crisis has become a greater security concern to the United States than terrorism. Workers have staged large protests in countries across the globe. On Friday, as many as 700,000 workers took to the streets of Rome to protest Italian Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi's economic policies. Here in this country, Congress has passed the $787 billion economic stimulus bill. On Saturday, President Obama hailed the bill's passage as a major milestone.
This historic step won't be the end of what we do to turn our economy around. but rather the beginning. The problems that led us into this crisis are deep and widespread, and our response must be equal to the task.
President Obama is expected to sign the bill on Tuesday in a special trip to Denver. While Obama praised Congress for approving the stimulus package, White House officials said Sunday Obama wants to revise the part of the stimulus package dealing with executive compensation. Congress capped executive salaries and bonuses at all institutions receiving federal bailout money, but the White House executive pay to be limited only at banks that received what it has described as an exceptional assistance from the government. In other economic news, President Obama's dropped plans to name a single car czar who would oversee the restructuring of General Motors and Chrysler. Republican lawmakers in Illinois are calling for U.S. Senator Roland Burris to resign after he acknowledged he had conversations with allies of former Governor Rod Blagojevich before Blagojevich named him to fill Barack Obama's Senate seat. In one instance, Burris said Blagojevich's brother had asked him for campaign donations. When questioned under oath last month, Burris failed to tell state lawmakers about these conversations. Some lawmakers are accusing Burris of committing perjury. Blagojevich was impeached or removed from office last month after he was accused of trying to sell Obama's seat. A federal appeals court in Richmond, Virginia, has overturned a decision that restricted the controversial coal mining practice known as mountaintop removal. Friday's decision reverses a 2007 ruling that the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers had violated the Clean Water Act in issuing permits for four coal mines. Friday's ruling is seen as a major victory for the coal industry. Environmentalists say Appalachia could now face up to 90 new mountaintop removal coal mining operations, which would destroy huge swaths of the Appalachian Mountains. A coalition of environmental groups, including Earth Justice, Sierra Club, and Coal River Mountain Watch, are now urging President Obama to ban mountaintop coal removal. In news from the Middle East, Israel's reportedly considering releasing imprisoned Palestinian leader Marwan Barghouti, who has been held since 2002. Israeli officials believe his release would likely bolster President Mahmoud Abbas's Fatah faction before any prisoner swap with Hamas. Barghouti is seen as a possible successor to Abbas to head Fatah. This comes as outgoing Prime Minister Ehud Olmert attempts to negotiate a last-minute deal with Hamas, under which Israel would release 1,000 or more Palestinian prisoners in exchange for captured Israeli soldier Gilad Shalit. Olmert said the release of Shalit is the top priority in any deal with Hamas.
This is the priority of Israel. First, Gilad Shalit. Second, the end of smuggling of arms across from the Egyptian border through Philadelphia line into Gaza. And third, complete, total ceasefire and any hostile activity by the Hamas from Gaza.
A senior advisor to Barack Obama said the president will soon issue an executive order lifting an 8-year ban on embryonic stem cell research imposed by President George Bush. Obama advisor David Axelrod discussed the issue during an interview on Fox with Chris Wallace.
When are you going to issue an executive order on stem cell research?
We'll be doing something on that soon, I think.
An executive order lifting the ban on federal funding?
The president is considering that right now.
In 2001, President Bush limited federal funding for stem cell research only to human embryonic stem cell lines that already existed. Scientists believe embryonic stem cell research could eventually produce cures for a variety of diseases, including Parkinson's disease, diabetes, heart disease, and spinal cord injuries. The New York Times reports the U.S. military will begin recruiting immigrants, offering a chance to become citizens in as little as 6 months. The program will focus on immigrants with special skills who are in the United States on temporary visas. This marks the first time since the Vietnam War the armed forces would be open to temporary immigrants. The private military contractor firm Blackwater Worldwide has decided to change its name in an attempt to rebrand the company's image. Blackwater will now operate under the name Z, that's spelled X-E, but pronounced like the letter Z. Blackwater's decision comes less than a month after the Iraqi government announced it'll refuse to renew Blackwater's operating license. In 2007, Blackwater guards killed 17 Iraqi civilians in an unprovoked massacre in Baghdad's Nisour Square. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton's arrived in Japan on her first trip abroad as President Barack Obama's chief diplomat. She also plans to stop in Indonesia, South Korea, and China. And a delegation of U.S. civil rights leaders has arrived in India to retrace the steps of Martin Luther King Jr., who came to India 50 years ago to study Mahatma Gandhi. Members of the delegation include Congressmember John Lewis, Andrew Young, and Martin Luther King III.
As the son of Martin Luther King Jr. and Coretta Scott King, to have had this wonderful opportunity to pay tribute to one of the greatest human beings that ever walked on our planet, the great Mahatma Gandhi. 50 years ago, my father and mother came to this country and spent about 30 days here. And on this occasion, we will only be able to spend about 2 weeks. But it is a special honor.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Investigators from the National Transportation Safety Board say Continental Flight 3407 was on autopilot before it crashed in icy weather near Buffalo, New York, Thursday. Officials say the flight from Newark Airport dropped 800 feet in just 5 seconds before crashing into a house. All 49 people on board and one person in the house were killed. Among those who died was 9/11 widow Beverly Eckert. She was a member of September 11th Families for Peaceful Tomorrows. Also on that plane, Alison DeForge, one of the world's foremost experts on Rwanda. She was 66 years old. Dr. DeForge was a historian of Rwanda, a human rights investigator, a senior advisor at Human Rights Watch, a recipient of the MacArthur Foundation Genius Grant, and an expert advisor to the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda. In May of 1994, a few weeks into the killings of Tutsis in Rwanda, she was among the first voices calling for the killings to be declared a genocide. In 1999, she wrote what is considered an authoritative account of the Rwandan genocide called Leave None to Tell the Story, Genocide in Rwanda. This next clip from Human Rights Watch is of Alison DeForge. She was speaking in 2004.
Why didn't the world react? That is a question that's almost as difficult to answer as why did Rwandans engage in the killing? Because the evidence was so clear. The argument that people didn't know, particularly at the highest levels of governments, that as Clinton told the Rwandans, you know, your voices didn't penetrate into my office. That's not true. They knew. We know now from intelligence records just how much they knew, that within hours they were aware that the killing was being done on an ethnic basis, systematically, that there were lists, that the killers were going through the capital city, choosing out people from certain households and executing them. They knew this. People had the impression that this was tribal warfare, that this was a repeat of something that had gone on forever, for centuries. And none of that was true. What was true was that this was a genocide fully as modern as the Holocaust, in the sense that it was state-organized and state-driven. At least 500,000 people were killed, and they were killed in 100 days. Does it have to be 800,000? Does it have to be 1 million to cross the threshold of horror? Isn't 500,000 enough?
Alison DeForge, on the occasion of the 10th anniversary of the Rwandan genocide, she later became very critical of the Tutsi-led Rwandan government headed by Paul Kagame and its role in the mass killings in both Rwanda and neighboring Congo after 1994. Last year, she was barred from entering Rwanda. Last Thursday, Alison DeForge was returning to her home in Buffalo after briefing European diplomats on the situation in Rwanda, Uganda, and the Democratic Republic of Congo when her plane crashed. I'm joined right now in the Firehouse studio by Kenneth Roth, the executive director of Human Rights Watch, who knew Alison DeForge for almost 2 decades. We welcome you to Democracy Now!
Thank you, Amy.
And condolences on the loss of Alison. When did you first meet her?
I really have known her for nearly 20 years. She was one of the founding members of the advisory committee that we set up when we launched what at the time was Africa Watch, but became the Africa Division of Human Rights Watch. And she started off as a volunteer, very quickly was working full-time for us covering Rwanda. And at some stage, I actually had to insist that she take a salary because it was ridiculous that she was devoting all of her time to this work and wasn't being paid a cent. So I've worked with her very closely during the genocide, afterwards, trying to seek justice for the genocide. I'm trying to make sure that the crimes of Paul Kagame are not forgotten, as you mentioned. And, you know, up until the end, this was not a young woman. She was 66 years old, you know, barely 5 feet tall. But she was working, you know, like a 20-year-old and really was a giant in the field whom we're really going to miss, all of us.
You also went with her to Rwanda.
Yes.
When?
I was there with her just 2 years after the genocide. And it was a very typical Allison experience because we had heard of a massacre in a very remote area of Rwanda. This was a period when there were still quite serious tensions in the country and you still found political killings. So we hopped in a Jeep and just drove out there and ended up finding a few survivors of the massacre and interviewing them in the middle of nowhere. And then as we were leaving, as night was falling, we bumped into the military patrol that probably was responsible for the slaughter. And they were not happy that we were there. And we proceeded to have a tense two-hour standoff with them on this hill with Allison basically negotiating our exit. And ultimately, we got out and drove very, very quickly back to the nearest town. But it was a scary situation, but it illustrated Allison. She was fearless. She was willing to drop everything to try to protect people. And she was incredibly committed to this work.
She was warning before the killings began.
Yes. No, in fact, she led an international commission that Human Rights Watch set up, which highlighted the ethnic tensions, the increasing tendency toward violence in the months before the genocide. So she really, I think, was the first to sound the alarm. Once the genocide broke out, I was working very closely with her, and it was frustrating because, first of all, no one even knew who the Tutsi and the Hutu were. There was some very basic education that had to be done at even the leading newspapers of the world. But second, as Allison just mentioned on that clip that you showed, there was this easy explanation that people offered for doing nothing, and that was that the killing was the product of age-old animosities, that this had been going on forever and there's nothing you could do. But in fact, it had not been going on forever. This was a very deliberate plan organized by a group of people that could be identified, pressured, and stopped. And indeed, Allison's 800-page account of the genocide, perhaps the most important conclusion of it, is that with very little effort, the international community could have halted the genocide. But it was the cowardice of the Clinton administration in particular that didn't want another African venture after the disaster in Somalia a couple of years earlier that just closed its eyes to the slaughter of what was about 800,000 people.
She was very critical of President Clinton, even when he landed on the tarmac and Rwanda said sorry.
Yeah. Well, he said sorry, if only I had known. And that is the least credible excuse I've ever heard. He knew exactly what was going on. Indeed, Allison was in the White House briefing Anthony Lake at the time, who was the National Security Advisor. They knew exactly what was happening, but they simply didn't want to risk the political capital that would be involved in sending the Marines into Africa yet again when they had had such a terrible experience in Somalia. But Somalia at that stage was chaotic. Rwanda was interesting because it's such an organized state, and it is very aid-dependent. And one thing that Allison found was that even the perpetrators of the genocide were extremely worried about what the consequence of this killing would be for the international assistance coming to Rwanda. So they were testing the waters. And when they found that there was no reaction, they proceeded with the genocide. But it would have taken so little to stop the genocide. But even that little bit didn't come out of Washington or other European capitals.
Well, one of the things that was remarkable to watch at that time and to listen to was the State Department, was the Clinton administration not wanting to invoke that word, right. Genocide.
Right.
How
right.
did they talk about it?
Well, the G word has legal consequences because under the international treaty banning genocide, there is a duty to suppress it. And so the Bush administration, or the Clinton administration, feared that if they said genocide, they would be obliged to act. So they ended up resorting to, you know, acts of genocide or sometimes just using the formulation, you know, ethnic slaughter or age-old ethnic animosities, anything that would avoid what they saw as a legal obligation to act. But the words didn't matter. The legal obligation was there, and they simply flouted it. They did nothing.
And so the lessons that Allison took from that, of course, it doesn't just happen over a 10-day period and it's over. And now we see what has happened in Eastern Congo, which is actually what Allison DeForge was focusing on now. Is that right? And Human Rights Watch just today has released a report.
Yeah, well, interesting. I mean, Ellison, the last thing she was doing was really helping us prepare the report that was released today, which highlights a particular aspect of the conflict in eastern Congo involving the so-called Lord's Resistance Army. And there actually are two parallel conflicts, one involving Rwanda very directly, the other more Uganda-oriented. But Ellison was deeply involved in all of this work. And I think one real attribute of her was how principled she was, because even though she was the foremost chronicler of the genocide, even though she served as an expert witness some dozen times before the International Tribunal set up to try the genocidaire, she at the same time, as a matter of principle, did not want people to forget the crimes committed by what at the time was called the Rwanda Patriotic Front, the rebel group combating the genocidaire, which then evolved into the current Rwandan government led by Paul Kagame. That group murdered some 30,000 people during and in the immediate aftermath of the genocide. It then was responsible for massive slaughter in eastern Congo. And Ellison didn't want those crimes forgotten. She was pressing the Rwandan international prosecutor to this day to pursue these cases. And I think it's that action on Ellison's part that led Paul Kagame to try to block Ellison from entering the country over the last 6 months.
Now, Paul Kagame does get a lot of support from the United States. Is that right?
Yes. I mean, I've been to conferences where Bill Clinton is squiring Paul Kagame around, and you can just see the guilt playing out. You know, Clinton did nothing to stop the genocide, so the least he can do is to usher around the president whose military force at the time was responsible for ending the genocide. But it makes me sick to see this, because Clinton, again, is, you know, deliberately oblivious to the blood on Kagame's hands. And even though Kagame is widely admired as a good administrator, he's helped build up the country economically, this is a man who has presided over forces that committed mass murder, and he should be held to account.
Explain where that mass murder was committed and how it extends into the eastern Congo now.
Yeah. Well, the part that potentially could be prosecuted by the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda involves some 30,000 people who were killed in Rwanda during the genocide and in the immediate aftermath, not by the genocidaire, but by Paul Kagame's forces. Then in chasing the organizers of the genocide into eastern Congo, at the time what was called Zaire, that action led to far more bloodshed. And indeed, Human Rights Watch has documented murder by Rwandan forces as far away as Kisangani, which is at the time, a Zairean town that was, you know, hundreds of kilometers away from Kigali. But this is, Paul Kagame is a man who has not stopped at mass murder when he saw it serving his political purposes. And it is sickening to see how closely Washington, London, and other European capitals still hold him, I think largely out of guilt at having done nothing to stop the genocide, but oblivious to the principles that Alison DeForest stood for, that no one should get away with these kind of atrocities, regardless of what they might have done with their lives.
And now Rwanda taking Nkunda, who is an ally of Kagame, and now saying that he is the enemy.
Well, there was a rebel force, a Tutsi-led rebel force in eastern Congo that had been led by Laurent Nkunda. And a couple months ago, it was threatening Goma, the principal town in eastern Congo, with, again, the possibility of massive bloodshed. Ellison was very involved in putting pressure on Paul Kagame to rein in this force. And indeed, he ultimately did succumb, arrested Laurent Nkunda, and has now arranged a sort of alliance with the Congolese government to allow the successor of this force to proceed against the Hutu militia who remain in eastern Congo. The problem is that the successor, a guy by the name of Bosco Ntaganda, is himself an indicted war criminal, indicted by the International Criminal Court. And so once more, you see sort of a compromise of convenience, ignoring justice for mass atrocities in the name of getting something done. And this, too, was something that Ellison was working to reverse at the time of her death.
The U.N. has authorized a U.N. force, to go in, but they haven't gone.
Well, in eastern Congo today, there is a peacekeeping force of 17,000 called MONUC, which is actually the largest peacekeeping force on the planet today, but is inadequate to the task because it is such a vast area that it must cover. And so at the urging of Ellison and others, the Security Council recently authorized the deployment of 3,000 more, but ideally 3,000 well-equipped, rapid-reaction troops who could actually protect civilians rather than simply watch them be killed, as seems to have been the case so far. That force has been authorized but not deployed. And indeed, what Ellison was visiting European capitals for just before her death was to try to convince them to deploy particularly so-called European battle groups. These are forces that are precisely created for this purpose, but that the Europeans are refusing to deploy because they just don't want to get involved in eastern Congo. So the end result is, you know, whether it's the conflict involving the Laurent Nkunda's former troops or the Lord's Resistance Army, the two parallel conflicts taking place in eastern Congo, in each case, the main victims are civilians, and the international community has troops there, but is not doing what it takes to save these civilians.
When was the last time you spoke to Alison DeForge, your folks at Human Rights Watch, and what she was wanting right now from her trips and her conversations with the European delegates?
Yeah. Well, I was talking with Alison just in the week before her death, and we were...
Emailing a report right from the airport before she got on that flight.
She was always working. I mean, she was incredible, and she was so dedicated to the people of Rwanda and the people of Central Africa. But it, just in the last week, she was concerned about some people in the United States who are being unfairly accused of having been participants in the genocide, and NBC was doing a documentary that seemed to have been exploited by the Rwandan government to pursue these people unfairly. She was also in contact with Hassan Yalo, the chief prosecutor for the International Rwanda Tribunal, trying to convince him to go after Paul Kagame's crimes before his tribunal shuts down. So she had, you know, a number of things in the work besides trying to protect the people of eastern Congo.
She tried to get into Rwanda twice and was denied?
Yes. I mean, she had been going to Rwanda, you know, forever. And in fact, Human Rights Watch has an office in Kigali. But beginning in September, when she would show up at the border, inexplicably she would be barred. And I remember calling the chief immigration officer and asking what was going on, and I would get, you know, bureaucratic mumble-jumble. But clearly what was happening was that Paul Kagame, the Rwandan president, saw that the end game was coming with the Rwanda Tribunal, that it was going to be over the next several months that his fate was going to be determined and those of his allies within the former Rwanda Patriotic Front. And he knew that the principal proponent of justice for those crimes was Alison DeForge. And his pathetic effort at retaliation was to bar her from the country that she loved.
Ken, you were just in Washington talking about issues like state secrets. What is this latest on the Obama administration twice invoking the state secrets privilege over the past 2 weeks, most recently in a closely watched spy case weighing whether a U.S. president can bypass Congress and establish a program of eavesdropping on Americans without warrant?
You know, I mean, this was a huge disappointment. Clearly, President Obama has begun to change a number of the disturbing aspects of the Bush administration's counterterrorism policy, whether it's, you know, insisting on a single interrogation standard for the whole U.S. government and basically taking the CIA out of the torture business, or vowing to close Guantanamo. But there are some parts that either they haven't focused on yet or they've made the wrong decision. And one of them is the one, Amy, that you mentioned, which is they seem to be continuing the Bush administration's policy of relying on the doctrine of state secrets to cover up inquiries by civil litigants into what went wrong with the Bush administration's policies, whether that's snooping on Americans or torturing suspects. The Bush administration regularly used the claim of state secrets in order to basically block these sort of civil litigation efforts. And unfortunately, President Obama's administration seems to be continuing that practice. We don't know whether this is just, you know, continuing on autopilot or whether there's a deliberate decision that has been made, but it's been a big disappointment.
What else are you demanding now of the Obama administration?
Well, I was just in Washington talking in particular about the question of how do you close Guantanamo, because the president has vowed to do so. He's begun a review of the cases there. And Human Rights Watch and others have been pushing him to adopt a policy of either prosecute or release. Clearly, many people there are there by mistake or are small fish and should just be released. Some of them are serious criminals, and they should be prosecuted in regular courts, not these substandard military commissions. The problem is that there are some in Washington who are pushing a third option. They want President Obama to continue having the possibility of detaining people without criminal charge or trial. And in our view, that would simply be continuing Guantanamo. It may be moved to you know, Fort Leavenworth, Kansas, or Florence, Colorado, but it'd be the same thing by a different name. And so we're urging the president to resist that, to adopt a clean policy of prosecute or release, but he's not there yet. I think he's leaning in that direction, but there's pressure coming in from the other direction, and we're trying to resist that pressure.
And what are you doing on Israel on the occupied territories with the latest assault on Gaza?
Yeah. Well, Human Rights Watch was barred from Gaza during the war, as was most anybody else. But we did have observers just on the outside who, for example, broke the story about Israel's use of white phosphorus, and they broke the story about Israel's use of these high explosive artillery shells, which basically can injure people within a 300-meter radius, an utterly inappropriate weapon to use in heavily populated areas such as Gaza. Right now, we have four people on the ground, and we are closely looking at how the war was conducted. And we're looking, you know, obviously at the claims that Hamas was shielding or hiding among civilians, but we're also looking at the allegations that Israel was using extraordinarily excessive force, that it was firing indiscriminately, and that its claims to care deeply about protecting Gazan civilians were simply not true. And we will be issuing a series of reports over the next few weeks with our conclusions, but this is a very deep preoccupation of ours at this stage.
I wanted to read you an excerpt of a piece by Muin Rabbani, who has been very critical of Human Rights Watch in dealing with Israel and Gaza. This is just two paragraphs from what he has said. He said, the Middle East has always been a difficult challenge for Western human rights organizations, particularly those seeking influence or funding in the United States. The pressure to go soft on U.S. allies is in some respects reminiscent of Washington's special pleading for Latin American terror regimes in the 70s and 80s. In the case of Israel, such organizations face a powerful and influential domestic constituency, which often extends to senior echelons of such organizations for whom forthright condemnation of Israel is anathema. And then he writes, in the years since 2000, Human Rights Watch pursued a consistent and consistently effective formula. Criticize Israel, but condemn the Palestinians. Challenge the legality of an Israeli aerial bombardment, preferably in polite technical terms, and vociferously denounce the Palestinian suicide bomber in unambiguous language, especially when raising questions about the latest Israeli atrocity. In Human Rights Watch publications, explicit condemnations and accusations of war crimes were almost wholly monopolized by Palestinians, with Israeli citizenship a seeming precondition for the right to self-defense. The right to resist was, for all intents and purposes, non-existent. That was a piece from Muin Rabbani. Mm-hmm. Your response, Kenneth Roth?
Well, he obviously gets into a number of things there, but let me make three quick points. I mean, first of all, his claim about, you know, pressure from U.S. funders is just pure fiction. Human Rights Watch, in the last 4 or 5 years, when we have, I think, been most criticized for our work about Israel, where we've been, you know, denouncing war crimes by Israel, we've doubled in size. It has had zero impact on our funding. And we've been very fortunate in that we have attracted a group of funders who believe in the principles that we uphold and understand you can't have principles for the rest of the world and not apply them to Israel. So we've built an organization that can survive that kind of criticism and has very well. Thank you very much. Second, we don't hesitate at all to call Israeli actions war crimes when they are. It's obviously easier to denounce as a war crime, say, Hamas's efforts to shoot rockets into civilian areas. That's you know, blatantly obvious. It doesn't take a huge investigation to figure that one out. Israel, it does take more of an investigation. If they're firing into a civilian area, you need to figure out what were they shooting at. Could they have hit it deliberately? Were they using the right weaponry? Yes, these are more complicated investigations. But if you look, for example, at the investigation that Human Rights Watch did in southern Lebanon, we were very capable of deeply criticizing Israel and calling things war crimes when they were. We have a long history of that. So these sorts of criticisms, frankly, we get them from both sides. You know, the people who reflexively support Israel regardless say that we must be biased against Israel, and we hear that all the time. People like Mr. Rabbani who you know, think we can never do enough want to criticize us from the other perspective. Final point, he says that we don't uphold the right to resist. And that, again, I don't even know where he's coming from there. Human Rights Watch never takes a position on why a war is fought, regardless of the side. We look only at how a war is fought. We apply the Geneva Conventions, and we say, you know, whatever your cause is, whether it's, you know, suppressing terrorism or fighting for an end to occupation, that's your business. Our business is to look at how you fight and as objectively and carefully as possible to hold both sides to the requirements of the Geneva Conventions. That's what we do day in and day out.
One of the things I've been, that on Democracy Now! We've been broadcasting the voices of Israeli Jews who have been fiercely critical. Just a few days ago, we had Avram Berg here, who is the former speaker of the Israeli Knesset, former Labor Party leader, who was fierce in his criticism. Avi Shlaim, the Oxford University professor, former Israeli soldier, who has been fierce in his criticism. Neve Gordon, the professor of political science at Ben-Gurion University, whose family was under the gun, the Hamas rockets in the Negev. They were in a bomb shelter, was debating Lanny Davis of the Israel Project. and here he was afraid for his family, but they were marching in the Tel Aviv peace protests, and they were saying that this assault is unacceptable. This latest assault, did it shock Human Rights Watch?
What was shocking to me was just the magnitude of the destruction that Israel seemingly deliberately tried to impose on the Gazan people. You know, maybe I shouldn't have been surprised, because if you look at the blockade over the last year or so, this was designed to destroy the Gazan economy. You know, this was far more than Israel's legitimate interest in keeping arms out of Gaza. This was an effort to simply squeeze Gaza. They didn't want people starving, because they knew that that would lead to outrage. So basic levels of humanitarian assistance went in. But other than that, there was no commerce allowed. And the economy grown to a halt. And that was a form of collective punishment that Human Rights Watch has repeatedly criticized. I guess in that light, it's not surprising that once formal armed conflict breaks out, there also seemed to be an effort to force the people of Gaza to suffer. Because we've seen already that Israel didn't simply target Hamas militants. It targeted a number of symbols of Hamas, political symbols, police stations, the parliament building. And if, you know, Israel has said, oh, well, we were just attacking anything that indirectly supported Hamas. But by that theory, Hamas would be entitled to, you know, attack post offices within Israel or attack the Knesset, because these might provide some kind of indirect support to the Israel Defense Forces. This is the wrong standard. International law is clear that unless something is directly supporting a military effort, it is inappropriately ever to target it. And Israel seemed to breach that basic requirement time and time again.
Kenneth Roth, I want to thank you for being with us, Executive Director of Human Rights Watch. We'll go out of this segment with the words of Alison DeForge, who died last Thursday night in the Continental plane crash near Buffalo, New York.
The legacy of the Rwandan genocide.
Thanks.
It's as if you took a picture of a family and ripped it down the middle and then tried to fit the halves back together again. Even with the best glue in the world, it's never going to be the same. People betrayed their deepest values in order to kill, in order to rape, in order to pillage their friends and neighbors and their own family members. Whether you look at it from the point of view of the victim or the point of view of the perpetrator, these are not things that can ever be forgotten. Justice is not going to erase the memory of the crimes, but it will provide people with some level of closure. At least they'll know it has been dealt with, it has been talked about, someone has been held responsible, and perhaps even ideally, the victim has received some form of compensation. So this is very important. It's very important that the truth be known, that the people who were killed be remembered, and that their killers be acknowledged.
Alison DeForge was the investigator for Human Rights Watch of the Rwanda genocide, moved on to Eastern Congo, and died last night coming home to Buffalo, New York, on the Continental flight that crashed into a house just outside Buffalo. This is Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. Mama Ararira. This is Democracy Now! And, of course, that flight that went down was last Thursday night, that crash just outside of Buffalo, New York. As we turn now to our next guest, an intellectual giant in African studies for the past four decades, in 2005, Foreign Policy and Prospect magazines named him among the top 100 public intellectuals in the world, written over 30 enormously influential books, including Towards a Pax Africana, The African Condition, Black Reparations in the Era of Globalization, The Power of Babel, Language and Governance in the African Experience, Islam Between Globalization and Counterterrorism, as well as the book The African Predicament and the American Experience, A Tale of Two Edens. He's written and narrated a much-discussed 1986 TV series on BBC and PBS called The Africans, A Triple Heritage. I'm talking about the Kenyan-born Pan-Africanist thinker Ali Masrui. He's Albert Schweitzer Professor in Humanities and Director of the Institute for Global Cultural Studies at State University of New York, Binghamton. Born in Mombasa in Kenya in 1933, Dr. Masrui studied in Manchester, New York, and Oxford, then became a professor in Uganda. In 1973, forced into exile by the Ugandan dictator Idi Amin, and has taught in the United States as well as at institutions around the world. In addition to his appointments at Binghamton, Professor Masrui is also Albert Luthuli Professor at Large at University of Jos in Nigeria, the Andrew D. White Professor at Large Emeritus and Senior Scholar in Africana Studies at Cornell University, and he is Chancellor of Jomo Kenyatta University of Agriculture and Technology in Kenya. Professor Ali Masrui joins us now in our Firehouse studio. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Delighted to be here, Amy, and congratulations on your very successful program.
It is great to have you with us. You have had many experiences in your life that really go to the connection between the United States and Africa. You met with the founding president of Ghana, Kwame Nkrumah, in New York, as well as other places. You were driven out of Uganda by Idi Amin, though met with him many times. You met with Jomo Kenyatta. You're the chancellor of a university by that name in Kenya. You met with the Queen of England and sat in a tent with Muammar Gaddafi and discussed world affairs. You just had tea with the Indian prime minister in November. This is the 100th anniversary of the birth of Kwame Nkrumah, the founding president of Ghana. It's also the time of the election of the first black president of the United States, his father from Kenya, Barack Obama. I heard you speak yesterday at the International Studies Association in New York, and you said it's bigger than that for Barack Obama.
Yes, indeed. Barack Obama is setting a precedent not just for the United States, but for the entire Western world. In none of the countries in the Western world with wide majority population has there been an election to install a head of state or a head of government who was black.
So you're saying he's the first black president of the Western Hemisphere?
And of the Western world. That is including Europe, not just the Western Hemisphere, but the Western world as a whole, because we keep on wondering when we'll have a black president of France, for example, although there's been progress in appointing ministers who are from Africa or from the world of color. And then a black prime minister of Great Britain would be very nice, and I'm sure it will happen, not necessarily in my lifetime, but probably in yours or in the lifetime of my children. And then, even more surprising, but historically, but perfectly understandable in modern terms, a black chancellor of Germany, and that will take a while. But I'm sure because of Barack Obama and breaking that original taboo in the Western world about appointing as heads of state people who are not of European extraction, It opens other doors around the Western world as well as the Western Hemisphere. And then Barack Obama himself becomes the most powerful single black individual in the history of civilization. You know, there's never been a person in control of the resources which the United States has, of the creative and destructive powers that the United States has. We've had great individuals in African history, like Menelik II of Ethiopia, or Ramses II of Egypt, or even more recent one like Kwame Nkrumah. Those were powerful within their countries or their regions. They were not globally powerful in the sense in which a president of the United States is. So he's easily the most powerful single black individual that's ever walked planet Earth. And that's a major breakthrough in race relations.
His father also is Kenyan, as you are.
Yes, indeed.
The significance of Barack Obama's links, his relations to Kenya.
Yes, well, although I didn't know the older Barack Obama personally, we share friends. They are friends even now. I talk to for information about the older Obama, and we are waiting for the first book about the older Obama, the father, which will be published in Nairobi.
Really?
Yes.
He was a student at University of Hawaii.
Yes.
Right? And also at Harvard?
Yeah, yes, he did go to Harvard as well, yes. And then he went back home and he had ups and downs with the authorities. Unfortunately, the way I have had ups and downs with the authorities.
What do you mean, ups and downs with the authorities?
Well, he, unlike me, he actually was a part of the government because he was appointed into the civil service. And then now and again, he took positions which put him into a bad light with the authorities, including his very strong position upon the assassination of Tom Mboya, who was a fellow Luo, but much more important, he was a potential next president after Kenyatta, and was probably eliminated because of those credentials, presidential credentials for Kenya. And the older Obama was trying to get the government to be much more serious about investigating and not to engage in cover-up, because the chances were that people in government knew about the plot to kill Mboya and were hiding. So he was a fairly brave man, and he was sacked out of the civil service on one occasion and then readmitted later on. He had ups and downs, but he didn't realize he had produced a son who would change the history of race relations in the world.
How do you respond to someone like critics like Glenn Ford? He writes for the Black Agenda Report, who says Obama will provide U.S. empire with a black face, and that could be very destructive.
It is a risk, really, because sometimes people are swallowed up by the position they occupy. I would hope he would help reshape the position he occupies, the presidency of the United States. And I've spoken, including in India, the one thing I hope he will avoid is initiate another military conflict for the United States, because since the 1930s, every single American president has initiated a conflict, either a large-scale war or some kind of confrontation with another country involving weapons. Everybody since Franklin D. Roosevelt. So my hope is he will break that tendency for the American president to feel the way to be really presidential and commander-in-chief is to be ordering an army into action on another society.
And what sense do you have that he will go that way? I mean, since he has come into office, we see one after another of these unmanned drone attacks in Pakistan. Of course, while he says he's going to draw down in Iraq, he's talking about a surge that'll double the force in Afghanistan.
Absolutely. So at the moment, I'm not optimistic that he'll necessarily be just a peacemaking president with the conflicts that are on. So my dream was he will be the first president not to start a conflict, not that he would be the first president not to preside over a war because he's inheriting two wars anyhow. And then with one of them, the Afghanistan, he's not planning to end it, really. He's planning to escalate it for a while. So that is disappointing, yeah. So my prayer was slightly different, that I don't want him to start a war with Iran. I hope he wouldn't start a war with Syria. He would be mad if he started a war with North Korea, you see. So in general, I hope he won't start any war and break this idea that a commander-in-chief has to be engaged in an actual war to be a credible president of the United States.
The Ethiopian invasion of Somalia that took place.
Yes.
Looking at modern conflicts and the U.S. role in that, Professor Masarui.
Oh, absolutely. I think although Ethiopia always has reasons for being suspicious about its neighbor, Somalia, and has reasons to engage in hostile action against Somalia, the actual use of troops to enter into Ethiopia and virtually be an occupying power had a lot to do with American encouragement to do so. So the Ethiopians were allowing themselves to be used by the United States against another African country, in spite of the fact that you could argue that Ethiopia had its own national interests at stake in Somalia, whatever happened. So we must be fair to Ethiopia. They weren't just doing Washington's dirty work, although they were doing that. But they had also good reason to be cautious about dealing with Somalia. But that was not the answer.
Professor Ali Masarui, we have to break one more time, but we're going to come back to this Kenyan-born Pan-Africanist scholar, intellectual, professor at Binghamton University, also at Cornell, and chancellor of a Kenyan university in Africa. Be back in a minute. Fela Kuti by Africa, the great Nigerian musician. We're talking to Professor Ali Masarui. He is known for, among other things, his series for PBS and BBC called The Africans. He's joining us in studio here in New York. You were invited to Prince Charles' 60th birthday party in Oxford, but you're turning him down?
Yeah, I'm afraid so. It's very tempting. Of course, you don't turn down an invitation to a royal occasion, least of all a British royal occasion, which is even more exclusive than others. And I did consider seriously going there, but it's really, first, it's a long way to go just for a banquet, and secondly...
What is your relation with Prince Charles?
Well, mainly because he's the patron of the Oxford Center for Islamic Studies, and I'm one of the trustees of the Oxford Center for Islamic Studies. So I serve on the board of that center, and I go to Oxford every year in connection with that center. And he's been remarkable in trying to reach to the world of Islam. He even gave a lecture at Oxford on Islam and the Western world, which was very Muslim-friendly. And he attempted to have the oath of coronation, when he does become king, changed to be not just defender of the faith, which originally envisaged defender of the Church of England, but defender of faith in the sense more generally of all religions, etc. But he's had trouble selling that concept to the people in charge of the rules of the coronation.
You will be celebrating your 76th birthday at just about the time he's celebrating his 60th birthday. But not that long ago, you were sitting in a tent in Libya with Muammar Gaddafi. When was that?
a few years ago, maybe 3-4 years ago.
Yeah. Well, now Muammar Gaddafi has been elected as head of the 53-member African Union. He's vowed to pursue his vision of a United States of Africa, where African nations join together in a unified state. He's proposed establishing a single currency, army, and passport for the entire continent. Tell us about him and what you think of his proposal.
He's definitely a very important individual for a head of state of such a small country, because Libya looks large on the map, but it's population-wise a small society. And he's been in power longer than I normally would recommend, because he's been in power 40 years this year. So that's too long, even by African standards, etc. Even in my conversations with him, he had already begun to change, that he was looking for a legacy in his capacity as an African and less for a legacy in his capacity as an Arab. In fact, in our 4 or 5 hours in his tent, one of the debates, I was trying to convince him of that he wasn't being fair to the Arab world. You can imagine me trying to convince an Arab leader, don't be so rough on the Arab world, etc. And in general, he is seeking a legacy as a great African. It may be because he's given up trying to forge a legacy as a great Arab. But in fairness to him, he has regarded himself consistently as part of the African scene, including at one time trying to save the regime of Idi Amin in Uganda by sending some troops there at the time Idi Amin's regime was in danger from troops coming in from Tanzania. And then his dream of instant United States of Africa, it's nice. Many of us have had that kind of dream, but I'm realistic enough to believe that the speed he envisages is not doable. Africa needs to have the stage-by-stage approach which the European Union has embarked upon ever since the Treaty of Rome in the 1950s, and they still haven't reached a federation of Europe. So I'm skeptical about his timetable for African unification, but I'm intrigued by the optimism that it can be done, and I like the idea that there are still Africans who believe that we are one and should attempt to be politically united, even if his particular approach is unrealistic.
I want to end on this centenary of the birth of Kwame Nkrumah. For viewers or listeners, particularly young Americans who've never even heard of him, we'll start part two of our discussion on him as well. But just briefly, in this last minute we have, explain who he is. Actually, we have 30 seconds, so it'll have to be very brief.
Yes, well, it's arguable he's the first post-colonial black president of the world. So Obama being the first black president of the Western world, Nkrumah was the first of the world in post-colonial terms. There were presidents in Liberia before him, but Liberia was not a regular type of colony. And Nkrumah, although I have described him as not a great Ghanaian in terms of what he did for Ghana, I've also described him as a great African, because he was the most ambitious pan-Africanist of the 20th century.
And we're going to leave it there, but we're also going to pick it up there in part two of our conversation, which we will play this week. Professor Ali Mazrui, I want to thank you very much for being with us. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.